The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So for the last few weeks, I've been kind of, or we have been, rambling around the topic of not-self. And I'd like to continue that theme and come from a slightly different perspective this morning. So the first day, I asked some people what were some of the things that were up for them, what were questions for them around this teaching of not self. And a couple of people talked about a curiosity about how to see this, how to directly experience and know this teaching, along with the other two characteristics. The teaching of not self is essentially part of a triad of insights that the term insight meditation actually refers to. So if we take the term vipassana, the term that is usually translated as insight, the passana part, the second half of the word, means something along the lines of seeing clearly. And the V part, the first part, the VI part, means something like various things. And the various things that this is said to refer to are the three, sometimes called the three characteristics, general characteristics of all experience. That as we meet our experience, we notice that there are specific characteristics about our experience, so that seeing has particular characteristics of form and color. Hearing has the pitch and tone. Bodily contact has hardness, heat, coolness, softness, vibration, fluidity. So there's these specific aspects of our experience that we touch into as we meet our experience with mindfulness. And then as we meet our experience with mindfulness, we start to see that no matter what we're looking at, whether it's pitch and tone or form and color or heat, coolness, hardness, softness, everything that we experience, including the mental aspects of our mind, the thoughts, the emotions, moods, qualities of mind that come together for meditation, calm, concentration, equanimity, peace, everything that we experience has these three qualities, that they are impermanent. And because they are impermanent, they are not satisfactory as being a place that we can rely on to be happy. That we can't essentially hang our hat on any experience and say, this is what will make me happy, because it's destined to change. So they're impermanent, they're unreliable as a source of happiness, as a source of lasting happiness, I should say, because they can be a source of this kind of an impermanent happiness. And this third characteristic is this characteristic of not-self, that nothing that we experience can be seen as an entity, a thing that is called me or I. And again, part of this has to do with the impermanence of every single thing in experience. And something that I think I pointed to last week, I definitely pointed to on Sunday, is that if we turn our attention to what we think of as I or me, we'll start to see that we can't really pin it down, that it's continually changing. And so everything that we even think of as I or me is also continually changing. So this notion that I am a solid entity, a thing, is revealed through our attention, our awareness, to be a fallacy. So these three aspects, they are really insights. So it's not so much that we try to see them, although we kind of try to see them. We can't so much make them happen. We can't say, now I will see not self, now I will see impermanence. But we can cultivate conditions that make it more possible for these insights to arise. Some of the conditions that support these insights arising has to do simply with hearing about them. There's an understanding that some of the wisdom that we come to as we meet our experience with mindfulness, that this wisdom is not so obvious, that some of this wisdom is not so obvious. And in fact, it, particularly around this teaching of not self, it runs so counter to what we normally think and how we normally perceive the world, that without kind of hearing this as a possibility, without hearing this teaching as a possibility, there is almost no way we would ever come to it. Because seeing our experience through this filter of an idea of self, because we're perceiving our experience in that way, we do not see evidence for the contrary. So it's as if this view that we're holding, this kind of, that we all hold, this idea of I am, everything that we take in confirms, or everything that we consciously take in confirms that belief. And though there may be experiences that point to the truth that there's just a changing flow of experience, no one here to direct, guide, no thing here, no entity, we're not likely to take in that evidence. And so part of the exploration here is simply around just hearing this possibility, hearing this teaching as a, well, put it in your mind and let it just stew, because it's not going to be something you can really believe. It's not something to believe. It's more something to explore, to investigate. So the putting this into your mind, perhaps if you then come across some information, some experience, let's say, experience, you come across an experience that you've previously seen but kind of just not really taken in. For instance, as I've mentioned quite a few times, we think we have some control. This part of what we think of as self is this ability to choose, and we think we have some ability to choose where we put our attention, for example. And we have some ability to do that. There is some ability to do that. There is an ability to choose. We can choose to attend to the breathing for a time. We can choose that. But we have no absolute agency over that, because we sit down, we try to meditate, we turn our attention to the breathing, and, you know, two breaths later, we're off wandering into thought. Who chose to do that? Was it a conscious choice that you chose to do that? It's habits and conditions that really chose that. It's conditions, habits and patterns that are in our minds that chose that wandering. It wasn't an I that chose it. So this hearing this teaching isn't so much about trying to figure it out or trying to see it even. It's much more of a just, can we hold our traditional notion of self somewhat lightly, and having heard this teaching, hopefully be a little more open to what experience we meet, to see it perhaps in a new way. So from this perspective of seeing this teaching as insight, not as something to do, I'd like to explore some of the suggestions the Buddha offered around looking at these views and perhaps holding them a little more lightly. His instructions on how to bring our attention to our experience such that these insights can manifest. The first instruction I'll talk about, and I don't know how many of these I'll get through today, we'll just see how far we get, is from one sutta. That I've referred to a lot. It's one of my favorites. And here he talks about how we normally see our experience.
Did you want to be stand?
Oh, no. No, I'm okay. How we normally see our experience through this perspective of I am. And he calls this unwise attention. So he says, an untaught ordinary person does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things unfit for attention and does not attend to those things fit for attention. So this is pointing to this quality, this capacity of the mind of attention, which is this capacity the mind has to choose where we take in information. This is one of those areas that we typically think of as I doing. But it is simply something that arises out of the choice, essentially, of what to pay attention to arises out of causes and conditions. It arises out of either habits and patterns. It perhaps arises because you've come here and heard that if you pay attention to the breathing for a little while, your mind might calm down a little bit, so you decide. Or the process of decision moves towards trying that. So he goes on. He says, this is how an untaught person usually attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present. thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So this is about the bringing attention to experience through this filter of I am. I'm sure you recognize these questions. These are the kinds of questions partly they are exploring in the Buddhist time, the contemplatives were exploring these questions in terms of previous lives, future lives. But we can also see these just in terms of how we are in our daily lives. I mean, this culture in particular is practically obsessed with how we have become what we've become through contemplating our past and thinking about what we're going to do in the future. So these questions, essentially, I mean, these questions are they kind of normal for us? They're the way we orient our planning, our thinking about who we are. And the Buddha says this is unwise attention. So what does he offer instead in terms of wise attention? He says, a well-taught, noble disciple understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, she does not attend to those things unfit for attention and attends to those things fit for attention. She attends wisely. This is suffering. She attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. She attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. She attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So many of you probably recognize those four aspects that the Buddha mentions around attending wisely as being related to the Four Noble Truths. That the Buddha suggests, and this wise attention that he's talking about, wise attention, is not so much a thinking about, which is more how the unwise attention was manifesting, was as a thinking about. What am I? How am I? How did I get here? Where am I going to go? How am I going to get there? That's more in the mind, reflecting about past and future. In the wise attention, you know, when I first read this, I thought, well, he's just telling us to think about the Four Noble Truths. But that's not what it's saying, actually. He says, one attending wisely attends, this is suffering. Pointing us into the present moment, pointing us into here and now to look at our experience through the framework of the Four Noble Truths, rather than looking at our experience through a framework of I am. So everything that we experience, normally everything we experience, is referred back to this sense of I, of me. What am I going to do this afternoon? How am I going to make enough money to pay my bills? How am I going to X, Y, or Z? So everything, much of what we experience, is coming through that lens, that filter, that perspective, that framework. And the Buddha suggests that's not such a helpful framework if you are interested in waking up. If you are interested in letting go of suffering, he suggests that instead of attending to things through the perspective of self, that we attend to things through this perspective of suffering. In the moment, is this suffering? Is this the cause of suffering? Is this the ending of suffering? Is this cultivating qualities that lead in the direction of the ending of suffering? Yeah.
Can you explain this
explain this? Can I explain this with different words? I will try. What is it in particular that is the confusion? And why don't you use the microphone so we can all hear?
It's not necessarily confusion, but it's when you refer to...
It needs to be turned on.
It needs to be.
When you refer to the looking through the... I didn't get it. Eyes of suffering or something?
The filter.
Of suffering.
Or let's say framework. See if we can see our experience through this perspective of suffering as opposed to the perspective of self.
Yeah, that's what I don't understand, because when I suffer, I suffer, and then I see that I suffer, and I keep suffering.
Yeah, okay, so that is a piece that I did want to kind of elaborate on a little bit. That if we are seeing things through the perspective of self, we often also will be seeing suffering through the perspective of self. I am the one who is suffering. And so that is, again, a kind of a shift around that perspective of self isn't something we can really do, but we can keep kind of just recognizing when suffering is happening and what are the conditions around suffering. So the other piece I want to bring in here is that, so the Buddha is recommending suffering as a perspective as opposed to self, and I think this is really interesting, because as I've been exploring these teachings, I've recognized there's a teaching called the teaching of dependent origination, and I won't go into that in full detail today. But it basically describes the process of how suffering comes to be. It describes that basically out of our mind and body, the mind and body meets our experience. We meet sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, things in the mind, thoughts, feelings, moods, emotions. When that contact happens, there's some kind of feeling around it. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. Out of that feeling, craving arises, either to want to keep things that are pleasant or want to get rid of things that are unpleasant. Probably space out a lot around things that are neither pleasant or unpleasant, not connect with things that are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So out of that very simple and basic experience of meeting all of our flow of experience, there's this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral stream that's happening. And we tend to try to grab onto those pleasant things and float down the stream on those and try to construct something out of those things. And we try to push away those things that are unpleasant, keep them out of our experience. So there's a craving that goes on around this feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. From that craving, that wanting, we start clinging. We start doing this construction. And we identify with the things that we construct. That identification process is the process by which we create self, by which the notion of self even comes to be, is through that process of identification. We identify with being the one who is doing this arranging. We identify with things that we've managed to hold on to for a short time as being mine. So it's out of this process by which suffering is created that the sense of self is also created. So there is, in this understanding of the way the suffering is created, it is the same process, identical process, by which this notion of self is created. And so, looking at our experience through this perspective of self, of suffering, looking at our experience through the perspective of suffering, you know, we can recognize when we are. It's suffering's pretty easy to touch into. We can see suffering is happening. We can recognize as we bring our attention to our experience, the more continuity of recognizing, knowing, experience moment by moment, we start to see habits and patterns, choices that the mind is making that are inclining us to go down this path that leads to suffering, inclining us towards getting angry or getting frustrated. And we start to see that with wisdom, with this seeing, the mind actually can choose to not go down that path. So let me just finish one more thought here. So the perspective, looking at experience, meeting our experience through where is suffering happening? How is suffering happening? How is suffering created? What is it that supports suffering to end? That perspective also inclines us towards being able to see this process by which self is created.
So you just described a process that I think I went through even last night, you know, driving home and being on the phone with someone where I got activated, talked about that, and I went to suffering. So what I wanted to do is see if the path I took, you know, what is, was it felt healthy, but what at the end, where do you think I am with this? I mean, because it activated in a response because fear comes up, it would have been something that I don't do now. And I actually stayed with the suffering, marinated in it, as someone would say, you know, and allowed some things to just flow in and out about where did this really probably come from, not my conversation with you. It wasn't you. And at the end, it seemed to be that I was in a better, calmer place, that maybe I even had some new insight into what had happened. Is that something, but where I was in suffering, but I just feel like there was a little bit of an epiphany that could happen, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And is that somewhat of what you're talking about?
It is. I mean, basically, the marinating piece, that is the, it's essentially, it's a willingness, you can just put it down, we'll just pass it around. It's a willingness to, in the moment, be with the experience as it is, as opposed to trying to figure out how to make it some other way. That process of simply meeting experience as it is exactly what the Buddha is talking about. And what he says, I mean, what I think this teaching is saying is that everything in our experience, it's not that we have to pick and choose only things that fall into these four categories. Everything in our experience falls into these four categories. Either we are suffering, that there's some suffering happening, or in the moment we can actually be seeing this craving, the clinging, the moving towards suffering, or the suffering is ended, it has stopped, or or there is this cultivation of qualities that are supportive of the suffering stopping. Everything in your experience can be viewed from those perspectives. And he suggests that this is a healthier way to view experience. And a lot of what it comes down to initially when we first start being with our experience is, meeting that suffering and being willing to hang out with it, to just feel it. And as you said, in your kind of hanging out with it. Now, this isn't a thinking about. That's the crucial distinction. If we're thinking about it, we're probably thinking about it from the perspective of what can I do to get rid of this? Can we just be with the feelings? Feelings in the body, how does the mind feel? In that process of being with, things may appear, thoughts may appear that, as you say, kind of bring some recognition or some insight into the pattern around this particular kind of suffering. I would call those psychological insights, as opposed to these insights into the impermanent suffering, not self. But they're very important in our path, these psychological insights, these recognitions of essentially, often, at least in my experience, often these psychological insights have to do something with a direct seeing, not a thinking about, but a direct understanding of the causes and conditions that have created this pattern in my life. The causes and conditions. So it's something of an understanding of the conditioned nature of this experience. So it's a little bit of that recognition of conditionality. So in that just hanging out with, sometimes these psychological insights can come to be. And they're very supportive, at least for me, those kinds of insights have made it easier to then hang out with a pattern that feels particularly difficult. You know, because that recognition, this is just the way things are because of the history of things. Now, this, again, is not a thinking about. It's not a what was I in the past, how was I in the past. It's kind of popping in through being in the moment. It's a thing arising in the present moment that's making that conditionality clear. So that kind of has a different flavor to it than the consciously reflecting back. Now, that consciously reflecting back can also have a place. We can come to some understanding. I think a lot of psychotherapy works that way, you know, that we try to understand our conditionality through thinking about. But in my experience, just thinking about it isn't enough. We really need to have these kind of really more deep recognitions of the conditionality as a direct experience, seeing this thing happening now as a result of conditionality.
And I'll just say, my practice is not to think, because I'm a walking thinking head, everyone says. I mean, my practice is not to think. So the practice last night that I was explicit about is just feeling, not trying to understand, because then I'll go to the head.
Yes.
Just being with it. Because when I do let go of the logical, where did it come from? Oh, it's oriented toward this. And just feel through it, it has an end because it is impermanent.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And then it, in some way, is less powerful.
Yes, exactly. That's another way of seeing that. I mean, essentially, you know, a little bit of a taste of the impermanence of that pattern also is very powerful. So, you know, the way through to more directly see these insights is this willingness to be with things as they are. The willingness to just meet experience and recognize, because there will be a feeling of I am suffering, I am choosing, I am doing things that help me to end suffering. There will be that feeling. There will be that, because it is so entrenched. But to see if you can also begin to recognize those processes as just part of what is happening now. The process of thinking that I am suffering, that is also something that is arising now. Can we just meet? What does it feel like to feel like I am suffering? And there we begin to get to more directly looking at that feeling of self. So the Buddha, you know, suggests that looking at suffering, looking at how we meet our experience, can we meet our experience directly, that we'll start to see how these processes, not only of suffering, but of this process of selfing arises. It's not so helpful in the process of meeting things as they are. So meet your experience, here you are, just whatever it is, feeling of frustration. It's not so helpful to try to dig underneath it and think or feel, and what is the I here that's feeling this, or what is, you know, how am I identified with something? That's not so helpful. Just meeting the frustration in its obviousness, just meeting that, you may start to begin to recognize kind of the feeling of I am. But don't look for that. There's no need to particularly look for that. When you can start to see that feeling of I am, you can turn your attention directly to that. What is that feeling of I am? And let's send the mic back to... Bud has... Do you have a question? Okay, we'll let Bud and then... Okay.
So can you ask the question, what needs to be let go of?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's not
that clear. That would... I mean, we can... You know, bringing in skillful means... Yeah.
So in reflective practice, that would be
appropriate. Well, there's several reflective practices, actually. This is another place that I wanted to talk about some of the tools, but you bring it up, so let's talk about that now. You know, what needs to be let go of? What is clung to? That's a great kind of thing to drop into the experience, not to try to find it. So the use of reflection in our practice... It's very skillful, and we have to know how to do it skillfully. Because often if we drop in thoughts of what needs to be let go of, we might have a tendency to then start thinking about, well, am I holding onto this? Am I holding onto that? But it's more about just dropping that in and see, is there some resonance in the mind and body around something that becomes clear? Oh, this is the thing. And sometimes we can, in that, just asking that question, something is clear and the system just starts to let go of it. Sometimes it becomes clear what's being held, and all we can do is just witness the holding, that just meet that feeling of just... I remember on some retreats, you know, just this feeling of just this clenching. My whole mind and body just felt clenched around something. I don't even remember what, but there was the very strong feeling of this clenching. And the thought that was in my mind was, I would let go of this if I knew how. There was nothing that the mind or body knew in terms of how to let go of it. It was really clear that this clenching, this holding was there. And all that I could do was just be with it. And it eventually disappeared because things are impermanent. So there's that dropping in of that, what needs to be let go of. That's very helpful. Again, without a reflection about it. Another reflection that's more directly to the point around selfing is if you're in the throes of something like that clenching, to drop in the reflection, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And this the Buddha recommends a lot, actually, as a reflection, to just keep bringing in that. It's essentially, it's a bit of wisdom not to try to force that view, or not to try to force ourselves to see something that we're not seeing. But by kind of bringing that wisdom in, it may allow the mind to, or to it's reminding the mind about that wisdom, and it may allow the mind to relax or to open around something in that way. So there's a couple of different kinds of reflections. So yeah, any other thoughts on that, Bud?
No, except it's the sense of loss, it's the sense of impermanence that creates suffering. There's suffering around the thought of losing something or something being taken away.
And say more.
I'm not sure I can.
Suffering, is it the thought of, are you talking about losing something, a deep kind of losing something, a sense of I kind of losing something, or is it more around things in the world, relationships?
Well, it's...
Because there's so many different levels of holding. I'm just curious where you're...
Yeah. I saw the ballet The Little Mermaid on Saturday. Anybody else saw it?
The ballet The Little Mermaid.
Yeah. The thrust of the story is that a decision is made that's virtually irrevocable, that causes great pain and a sense of things being changed forever for the worse. And it's just that sense magnified creates suffering. And it fits in with with things changing and not being permanent and so on. It's kind of a very difficult scenario.
Okay, so the suffering around things changing has to do with the wishing it were otherwise.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's not the changing itself that causes the suffering.
Yeah.
And that's hard for us to believe. That is kind of hard for us to believe at times. Yeah. But it isn't the changing itself that causes the suffering. It's our relationship to the change.
Well, the only way to deal with it seems to be experiential. You have to get into the feeling, into the bodily sensations of it. And,
right. As we start to, and I think I said this at one point too, the meeting of experience, meeting the direct experience, we start to see, I mean, one of the first things we start to see is that things are impermanent. And there's a lot of, you know, when we actually really see that things are impermanent, you know, it's hard. The seeing into impermanence is like it's not quite complete. We really see, yes, things are impermanent. Everything goes away. And there's still some wishing it were otherwise. There's still some wishing that I could make things otherwise, or that things were otherwise. And as we continue to be with experience as it is, the insight into that recognition of impermanence becomes deeper. And we start to see, I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, these three insights kind of, they're related. They come together. That as we see things are so deeply impermanent, and there is no one that needs to do anything or change anything or fix anything, then there's more of a relaxing into the notion of impermanence. And what I've experienced in my own life, in my own experience, you know, the recognition of impermanence, actually, I'm going to bring in a kind of just a brief teaching around the kind of insights that we go through along the path towards awakening. And an early insight has to do with this notion of change, of just seeing things are coming and going and coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. And that tends to be a kind of a really happy experience, because there's a just meeting things coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. And as we keep going, as we keep paying attention, the mind starts to more recognition, things are ending, 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 things are ending. And there's a period of time in practice where we go through part of the path, not something that we can avoid, feelings of disgust, of terror, of fear, of loathing, that this is the way things are. It's part of the path to have to essentially go through those aspects of really meeting the loss, essentially. And a very late insight has to do with equanimity, that we begin to come into balance around the fact that everything's disappearing. And that's where, really, I think the insight around not-self comes in. And in my own experience, the meeting of these aspects of impermanence, it's like seeing different aspects of impermanence and really starting to see things just disappearing, disappearing, disappearing. It's not an easy place to be. It's not a comfortable place to be, and the mind kind of rebels against it. So seeing impermanence in its many forms is hard. When the understanding of equanimity and of not self begins to come in, it's a relief that, it's interesting to me, and I think I said this in the last couple of weeks, the teaching of impermanence is something that we all think, oh yeah, that one's not hard. I get that one. But in the path towards awakening, really getting impermanence is not easy. It is very challenging to our system. The insight into not self, that one's really hard for our minds. The mind does not want to go there. But when we actually meet that experientially, no problem. There are no problems. So it's kind of interesting to me, that kind of flip around these two particular insights, that, when we hear the teaching of impermanence, it's like, oh yeah, no problem. We hear the teaching of not-self, it's like, oh, don't tell me that! People get angry, they get upset, just hearing intellectually about this teaching. This is because these two teachings are being filtered through our ideas. We think we understand impermanence through an idea. We have trouble understanding this not-self through our concept, and it makes us feel very uncomfortable. But the experiential meeting, when we meet experience and really begin to feel the impermanence, really experience it, that's very unsettling. When we really meet experience and really recognize no one here, that there's just this changing flow of experience, no one needing to fix or change or do, no one here even feeling or experiencing, just experience arising. Experience and the knowing of it. Experience and the knowing of it. Over and over and over again. That's a relief. So, no? Okay. Anyone else have any thoughts? Or yeah, Victor.
What I get, I don't know if caught up is the right word, but it's the experience and the knowing of it, memory gets misapplied, where it's really the memory of our experience that generates notions of self. You think about aspects of yourself you project in the future, the past, the present, things like that. And it's from your talk on Sunday, it occurred to me that there's a great misapplying of memory to
the,
what we do.
The, this is the aspect of perception, the five aggregates that I talked about last week and talked about on Sunday. form or body, feeling, the a process by which we feel experience, the process by which we recognize experience, the memory, perception, the process by which we know, just the meeting, the bare meeting of experience, and the process by which choice happens, decision happens, the process by which there's formation of experience. So the perceptual process, I think you're right, that is a huge place. The misunderstanding of perception, the misunderstanding of, you said memory, the misunderstanding of that is a huge place where this idea of self is just created out of. Yeah, I mean, it's and that's actually, that was a thought I had about talking about for next week, is watching, seeing how that process kind of
manifests.
Yeah. And so there's a lot to talk about with perception and that confusion around perception. One fundamental mistake we make is that we see things through perception, like book, you know, this is a book. And it's a shortcut, a perceptual process is a shortcut essentially for recognizing and maneuvering the world.
Yeah, it's a placeholder.
And we interpret that shortcut as the reality. And that's again, that's a kind of a hard thing. Isn't there a book here? Well, there is at one level. I mean, we can use it. We can use it as a book. You know, I can read from it. I can hold it and touch it. But the direct experience of this thing is not book. It is, right now, hardness and heaviness. If I open it up, there may be more concepts coming in. I don't know who it was, but it's kind of a famous saying. The thought of your mother is not your mother. And that is, you know, the thought of the book, and book is inherently concept, is not the book. So again, the Buddha keeps pointing us back to just direct experience, direct experience, direct experience. Now we need our concepts. I mean, this is not about trying to cut out this perceptual process. You know, the perceptual process is an automatic, ongoing process that has made us able to maneuver the world. So it's very useful, and we can't actually stop that perceptual process. I think, if we could find how the perceptual circuits worked in the brain and cut that link, we would be pretty non-functional in the world. So the recognition around this isn't to try to stop perception, it's to understand the process accurately. So we're not trying to stop anything that's already happening. Even this formation of this notion of I am is useful, as I think it was, well, somebody, it might have been Bud, said one time, I still have, you know the size of shirt I have and all of that kind of stuff. You know, it's useful, it's a useful construct to have this notion, but it is misunderstood. So we're not going to lose anything, actually, with this understanding. What happens, actually, is we just shift our understanding, that it's a recognition of the way things are, as opposed to what our ideas and beliefs are about reality. Did you have something more?
It's knowing where the edges are, because it's so amorphous, the notion, that aspect aspect of perception, and that it's looking at the habit of mind and thinking, using I use perception as a placeholder for so many things that I attribute to having more solidity than not.
Mm-hmm.
The example I give is what I came up with. Here's a pen. Now, the notion of memory and perception knows that I put the pen there. It's a shortcut so I can go back. But the pen isn't really there, I mean, as far as the felt sense of the pen.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, but we use that in such a facile, natural way to maneuver, create our world, our life, whatever, that it's really so difficult to see where the edges are of...
And in terms of looking at the edges there, the place that I think, again, I want to just keep coming back to, what's obvious in your experience? Because using these ideas about, okay, perception is kind of a place where we get lost, how can I see the edges of perception? We can get into thinking about being with our experience through a process of thinking again, as opposed to really meeting experience as it is. And so one of the explorations that I find really helpful around all experience, but this points to self, look at in your experience what seems solid to you. Now, that might be something like pain. I used that analogy on Sunday. You know, pain sometimes seems really solid. You start looking at pain with just meeting the experience of pain in your direct experience, and you start to see it start breaking apart, that it's not so solid anymore. We start to see that there's not a solidity there. So whatever you are experiencing as solid, whether it's a solid feeling of anger or a solid feeling of happiness and bliss or a solid feeling of pressure on your butt or a solid feeling of pain, look at that. Look at that sense of solidity. Just meet it. Again, what's obvious about that feeling of solidity? Not to try to make it break apart, but to just meet it. Just what is that solidity? If you are looking at something through a filter of solidity, it will tend to reinforce that feeling of solidity. If you kind of hold that a filter of solidity lightly, you might begin to see that there's really a very rapidly changing experience that is kind of the ground of that solidity, or the thing that solidity is then constructed on top of. So it's 11. So we'll continue next week. Thank you.